Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis. Welcome to Podcast UFO to episode number 21 with Travis Walton. I was very honored to have Travis on as a guest, a man of total integrity. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, that's twitter.com/podcastUFO. If you'd like to email me, that's info@podcastUFO.com. I think today's show is a very good one, and I hope you enjoy it. I'm in Gorham, Maine, with Travis Walton. How you doing, Travis?
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for... I've been wanting to have you on this show, and I am absolutely thrilled because I was speaking with Kathleen Marden, who's in an earlier podcast, and saying the two most documented cases that I know of, your case and also Betty and Barney Hill. So I'm absolutely thrilled to have met you here today. You've told your story, would you guess, probably 10,000 times?
Oh, many, many times. I don't have an estimate at all, but it's a lot. But.
Yeah. So we're going all the way back to, what was it, November 5th, 1975, if I remember?
Yes, it was a Wednesday, November 5th, 1975.
Yeah. And I'm sure that 99% of the listeners that listen to my show know your story. But if just, I am listened to all over the world now. I can see that through the analytics of my site. So if you can just give a really quick recap for the person who perhaps doesn't know your story.
November 5th, 1975, I was working in the woods with a group of six other men and headed home at night. We saw a glowing object hovering near the road. I got out to take a closer look. I was hit by a bolt of energy from that craft, and The rest of the crew took off in fear and reported it to the sheriff, and they were basically suspected of murdering me and making up a cover story for why I was no longer around. And I regained consciousness on board the craft, and it was a very traumatic experience. I was returned to the town nearest where it happened, where I could go and get help. And I called my family, and they came and got me. And at that point, it was just a matter of dealing with the reaction to the report, not just mine. It was worldwide news by the time I was returned.
Now, and it's totally changed your life. And I've heard you say in other interviews that if you could do it all over again and that be a minus factor in your life, that's how you'd really like it.
Yeah. I'd rather it never happen, but, you know, I've got to go with the way things have fallen together, and it's the way it is.
Now, how many lie detector tests have been taken that...
Well, back when this first happened and the men were accused of murdering me, the president of the American Polygraph Association said the odds were over 1,000,000 to 1 of there being any kind of a mistake with that many people all passing a test on a single issue. Now, since then, there's been over 16 passed tests in regard to this incident, you know, the crew, my family and whatnot. I've passed 5 different lie detector tests from 3 different experts, and so I don't know what the odds would be now with over 16 passed tests, but it'd be a lot more than 1,000,000 to 1.
Yeah. I want to ask you a couple of questions. When the bolt hit you, did it just all go blank right then? Do you remember nothing?
Felt a sort of a numbing, sort of a stunning shock, sort of an electrical shock, and blacked out.
So when you were tossed that 10 or 20 feet or whatever it was, you were completely out at that point?
Yeah, I was unconscious. By the time I hit the ground, I was completely unaware of what happened after that.
Now, I heard you say that when you awoke in the craft that you had a hard time breathing. And, you know, the very first thing I think of is you know, whatever mixture of oxygen or whatever that is in that craft is probably different from our earth and our air and stuff like that. Do you think that's why you were having a hard time breathing?
Or? That's probably the most likely explanation, although I did consider that being hit by the beam in the head and chest may have caused some sort of injury that added to that problem. Could have been part of it or maybe all of it. Very likely just the wrong atmosphere for humans.
Yeah. And then the creatures that first approached you, there was no real communication there, but I remember you saying something about you saw they had irises and they had large eyes. Can you kind of describe what you saw?
Yeah, they had very large eyes. And, you know, I found their stare extremely difficult to bear. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, I've come to the suspicion that the reason for that was that they were trying to reassert control over me.
Hmm.
That feeling that they were boring into me or that there was some kind of invasive quality to their stare had to do with them trying to calm me down and get me to quit making these threatening gestures. It's the only thing I can explain why it was just so disturbing, their stare. That was the main feature of my nightmares for some time after that.
I was going to ask you about nightmares. Do you still have them at this point?
Well, I don't remember having them. It may be that they're buried so that when I do have those dreams of that nature that I wake up and I don't remember them anymore, but either that or I'm not having them.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall, I'd like to talk a little bit about the craft experience, if I could, because that's so unique compared to what I would consider most people who claim to have this type of situation. Were there any smells that you recall?
Well, you know, again, my injuries might have interfered with my sense of smell, which isn't all that keen to start with, but it did seem stale and humid and, you know, really kind of muggy. But, again, that might have been because the atmosphere wasn't right.
And the walls and things like that, how can you describe?
It was very geometric and very mechanical and very clean and sterile looking, as opposed to the look in the movie, which was very organic and rather cluttered.
Right. Now, and the human-like person that approached you with a helmet, a mask on or something, that didn't speak and then brought you to an area where you saw other crafts, almost like a hangar of some kind?
Yeah, he took me outside of the craft, which, you know, I don't know if the craft that I awoke in was always during that time inside of this hangar-like area, this large room. But there were other craft in there, disc-shaped craft, but they were more rounded and shinier than the one I came out of.
Now, I can't even imagine what was going through your head at this time when you were experiencing all this. Like, I would think that I would feel that there's no way I'm ever going to get home. I'm done for. I
mean, yeah, it was definitely a feeling of being lost and a very desperate, sort of hopeless feeling about, you know, would I be returned? Was there some bigger threat yet to you know, become apparent to me?
Mm-hmm. But this experience aboard the craft or whatever it was seemed in your mind like it lasted a fairly short time?
Yeah, certainly nothing like the 5 days and 6 hours that I was missing.
Hmm. What was your, when you finally woke up and to familiar surroundings, what was your thought on how long you'd been gone approximately? You thought it was the night?
Yeah, I thought it was still the same night, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was only after I had some kind of an exchange with my brother about, you know, all that had been going on that I you know, my brother, he realized that I thought it was the same night. He said, feel your face. You've been gone for 5 days. And I felt a growth of beard. And then I looked at my watch, and it had changed the date. And so that was kind of an extra shock for some reason. It really just kind of finished me off.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Yeah, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but for the immediate time, I know you went to Phoenix to a hospital there to be tested or whatever, but was the media like right on you from that point out?
Yeah, there was intense media scrutiny. You know, one of the crewmen, Steve Pierce, relates the story of waking up to find news photographers trying to take his picture through his bedroom window. And, you know, my mom's having her flower bed trampled by people trying to take pictures through her front window. And so they were honest. You know, when I went to get my brainwave scan, I was put in there by the doctor under an assumed name, but still coming out to the car, somebody yelled, there he is, and they actually chased us through traffic. So it was really a crazy time. It seemed like everybody was really keen on the whole issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, before any of this ever happened, what was your thoughts about UFOs and things?
Well, I you know, definitely considered that this was a reality because my brother had seen something about 8 or 10 years before at fairly close range, and you know, so it was definitely something I thought was probably real, and you know, it wasn't like a hobby of mine or an obsession in any sort of way because. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was interested in a wide variety of subjects, and, you know, that was one of the topics of the day back then, and many, many subjects.
Now, when you got out of the truck, what possessed you to get out? I can't imagine if I saw something like that getting out. Was it to kind of show off a little brazen?
Well, it was a little bit of a show-off element to it there, I have to confess. But, you know, both Steve and Alan both says to them it looked like I was in some kind of a trance. But I guess if I was mesmerized, it would have been in the sense that, you know, I was beholding this incredibly powerful sight. It was just so overwhelming, the reality of the situation and the power of it and the you know, the strangeness of it was just so dazzling.
I recently saw Chasing UFOs, National Geographic, and I also heard you talk about this, the growth rings in the trees. Has anyone taken a scientific look at that?
Well, samples were sent to a lab, and I'm getting ready to take some more samples to send to a lab, maybe more than one. There's got to be some follow-up on this. National Geographic was supposed to do that, and they took samples, but to my knowledge, none of that went very far. So that whole show was quite a disappointment. I anticipated with National Geographic's great reputation for some really good documentary and scientific reporting, did a terrible job with that show, and they just really botched it. They actually flew a scientist in there that was there for the purpose of looking at those samples, and she was never even, just basically cut out of the show.
Wow.
So they wasted a whole lot of time showing them driving to the site and talking in the car on the way, and it was just a
trying to make it the total reality.
And then some kind of night vision stuff. What was that about?
I think that's, to me, that's kind of the most disappointing part of that show. I tried to talk with James Fox on this podcast. I haven't heard back from him. But that night vision thing with the camera facing the people as they're walking along, it's kind of, in my opinion, kind of hokey, you know, a little bit. So
what are they looking at? Why are we supposed to impress that they're looking out there scared if they're never going to turn the camera the other direction?
And not only that, it's like for someone to actually experience a sighting is so rare. You know, I mean, chasing UFOs, I mean, the title works well and everything. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's just that whole part of it. You know, we can only look at the past and be very, very, we would be very, very lucky to have something happen that we could actually witness. But, you know. So was that filming all done in one day when you were involved?
No, I spent 3 days with them. There was more than one day of filming, and it was a lot of time wasted, in my opinion, because they just decided to just spoof the whole thing, and I don't think they had a serious... Not James Fox. Right. I really think he...
He's pretty solid.
Yeah, I think he was as disappointed as I was.
I've heard that through the grapevine.
That he definitely had the idea it was going to be a lot better than it was. I know he didn't have any control over content or editing, so...
Yeah, that's where everything can change as well.
Yeah, vastly. People don't realize just how much editing can alter what a person does or says.
Yeah, I know you've said in the past that there are times that you just don't want to talk about this. And were there, like, many years that have gone by... I think this sort of, in a way, gives you even more credibility, because anyone who experiences something traumatic is going to want to shut it out for a while and maybe revisit it. Has there been long stretches where you just didn't want to talk to anybody?
Yeah, there was definitely long stretches of time where I didn't want to talk about it, and I'd turn down interviews or appearance requests and whatnot. But then, you know, something would provoke me, maybe some of the more outrageous things that people make up. Sometimes people will say things to get their little 15 minutes of fame on the internet and just make up stuff, and it's just so outrageous and so easily disproven as false that I get provoked into rejoining the battle, so to speak.
Can you give an example?
Well, there was a guy that came on there a while back and claiming that he was the sheriff's nephew and he had the inside story on it all. And well, you know, it was just one thing after another that, you know, even the people on the website that he was talking to jumped his case and said, well, that can't be because of this and this, you know. Mm-hmm. He had his facts all wrong 6 ways from Sunday. For one thing, the sheriff that investigated the case was not his uncle. The uncle that he was claiming was the town marshal, who had no real central role in the investigation. But he was he claimed that the crew met with the sheriff at the Red Robin Diner. And the Red Robin Diner didn't exist for another 20 years after that.
Wow.
And then so they jumped his case about that, and he changed it to the Red Onion Diner, which does exist in Heber, but that, too, didn't exist for another 20 years. So, you know, he made all sorts of absurd claims that it was really an Air Force helicopter that chased the crew through the woods. And that's silly, too, because, you know, the blades would hit the trees.
Oh, yeah.
And who could possibly mistake a low-flying helicopter for anything with
the
distinctive sound and the wind blowing downward? Just point after point after point, you know, it was just so easy to prove that he was, you know, just trying to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the only one. You know, there's all sorts of people that come on there and... make claims.
I'm sure. The guy that James Garner played in the movie, is it James Garner?
Yeah, James Garner played Sheriff Waters, I think it was Sheriff Waters.
Okay, I want to talk about Sheriff Waters, if that's his name. He was pretty arrogant and non-believing in the movie. Is that the way he was in real life?
Oh, no. I think he was a very likable fellow, and I think he was much more believing off-screen than on. He was very friendly, and he was really a good guy.
Oh, okay. So there was a lot of differences between what happened and what was in the movie, basically. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you like to always set straight that is... that people might talk to you about that happened in real life but didn't happen in the movie?
Well, you know, I think some of the changes are understandable. They reduced the crew from 7 to 6.
And why was that, I wonder?
It's just that they need to reduce the number of people for the audience to keep track
of. Yes, I understand. You
got 90 minutes to tell a story that spanned years, and you can't just keep throwing more and more and more and more characters at people and have them be able to keep track of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when they combine my brother Don and Dwayne into one named Dan, you know, that's understandable from the purposes of telling the story and the overall impact that it had. The things I don't agree with are things like the very great departure from reality that they made on events aboard the craft. Mm. But it needs to be understood that I did not approve those changes. And Tracy Torme, who wrote the script, fought hard to preserve the integrity of the story, but it basically came down to they wanted to make these changes or there was not going to be a movie.
Wow.
So faced with those choices, he opted to go ahead and have the movie made, which I'm glad he did.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he, like I, would have, you know, if we'd had our druthers, it would have been a more accurate story. And maybe someday there'll be a remake to tell it more accurately.
Has anyone talked about that?
Well, there's certainly a huge amount of demand for it. I've got hundreds of emails that I will, you know, print out and bind and bring to a potential producer to demonstrate that there is I'm getting these emails from all over the world that people, you know, are aware of the book and they're aware of the movie. They're fascinated, but they would love to see a movie that told it the way it really happened.
Mm-hmm. You know, I lived sort of local in this area. I lived in New Hampshire when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember hearing about it. You know, so it was all over the world for a while. Is that right?
Yes, it was worldwide. Even before I was returned, by the time I was returned, there were camera crews in town from Japan and England. And, you know, eventually reporters and filmmakers from just about everywhere wound up coming to do the story on it.
Now, did you ever feel like you had to move away?
I was tempted many times to move away from all the controversy and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the movie, it makes it look like the whole town was against us. But it was actually worse than that, in a sense, because the town was divided and along family lines. And, you know, the town marshal didn't believe it, but his brother, the county deputy, was believing. But his wife was not believing, and his brother's wife was more believing. So between brothers, both in law enforcement, and their wives, there was a split four ways there on opinions.
Hmm.
And but over time, things have gotten better.
Did you tell your experience of the abduction part of it right away?
I couldn't really get it out. I was so traumatized that every time I started to talk in detail about what happened, I'd break down. So it wasn't until the hypnosis that I was finally able to relate in detail what had happened, because the whole technique there was to separate the fear from the memory.
I see. And I know that the debunkers or skeptics have used that part of it, saying that those memories were implanted.
Well, you know, the hypnosis was witnessed by a number of other researchers, including two
really?
Psychologists,
mm-hmm.
Psychiatrists. So, and they were of the opinion that they expressed that all the signs of genuine hypnosis were in evidence there, and that there was no bad technique in terms of leading questions or planning memories or anything like that.
Now,
for one thing, you know, little bits of it had come out prior to that, and it was all in agreement with that. It's just that I couldn't, you know, continue into a continuous narrative of it because it was just too much.
Now, I know that whenever I talk about certain traumatic experiences in my life, that I get right back there in my mind, and it really affects me. Do you ever get emotional about any of this when you're
It definitely, and for years after it happened, when I'd talk about it, it was reliving it to the extent where I was going through, a high percentage of the level of stress that I had experienced when it happened. And even now, to talk about it, I have to go back there in my mind and relive it to a certain extent. So it's taken, over 30 years to desensitize me to the degree that it has, but it's still not easy to talk about and nothing I bring up on my own.
Has this affected any type of career of yours?
Well, obviously, having had this happen, has affected me in many ways I can't begin to calculate. Jobs I might not have gotten, sometimes people aren't specific about their reasons for things, but you can sure surmise. And obviously watching the kinds of tactics that are employed in political contests today, you can definitely know that that's one thing that I could never do is run for public office because, the obvious cheap shots are right there apparent from the beginning. So there's many things that career choices that I feel like are probably completely closed off to me on account of having had this happen to me.
Now, did you stay in the lumber?
Well, I did have to go back to the woods, and I did for a while. It's just one of those things that you need to go back to in order to not, it's kind of like falling off a bicycle.
Yeah.
You've got to overcome any fear reaction that way. So I did, but then, I went on to other lines of work.
Now, have you been contacted by people at any given time that have seen sightings in the area? Are you aware of sightings?
Well, the sheriff did have in his file a number of reports from people who had seen things in the area at that time. I've also had people approach me that were in the area at that time and telling me about things that they had seen. So some of them coincided with my event, and some of them were things that have occasionally, in years later. But quite a few, right about the time this happened.
I think I heard you say in a talk about a deer hunter that ended up being false information he was giving.
Well, yeah, that's a long story, but yeah, there was a deer hunter who turned out, it sounded like, we had someone that was in the vicinity at the time and saw the incident and everything. But when he was polygraphed, it turned out, yeah, that was all true, that he was there, and even that he was in military intelligence, as he said. However, when he was questioned about having had contact with the main skeptics and debunkers that were attacking the case, he flunked a second test on those sorts of questions. So it's a very curious sort of situation how someone could have been present, a person in military intelligence standing nearby with a high-powered rifle in his hands, and yet be trying to hide his relationship to the debunkers and the skeptics. So that was a very strange result.
It is. Yeah. Another thing, I also heard you say that there was, or I believe I heard someone say that there was an offer of $10,000 if someone admitted this was a hoax.
Yes. One of the main skeptics, debunkers, did make the offer of $10,000. And there's a lot of documentation for this. For one thing, a tape exists. But besides that, the very first offering of the bribe was delivered by a local law enforcement officer who came to the door of the crewman to whom the offer was made. And this offer was pushed over quite a length of time and almost got him to make up a story just to get the $10,000. But, all in all, he wound up not doing it because he,
Look at the pressure that everyone's been under. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And just if he had taken that money and done that, that would have just squashed this whole thing.
Well, I don't know, because, you know, I would have immediately challenged him to take a lie detector test, that this news story that he was telling, and he would have been really stuck there, because he would have had to either refuse to take it or take it and fail.
He'd probably skip town with the 10 grand.
Yeah, that's the way that would have gone. Although, you know, it would have been sufficient for some people, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Even though it was widely known that he'd been offered the 10,000. Mm-hmm. And that was even in my first book that came out in 1977. But it doesn't take, you know, if people are desperate to have something to hang their hat on, something with which they can dismiss this, the silliest explanations. We talked about the hypnotist planting memories. Mm-hmm. Well, there was also the theory that I'd had a transitory psychosis or that I'd been hallucinating on drugs. But, you know, what all three of those, the hypnosis and the psychosis and the drug theory, don't take into consideration is six other people mm-hmm. having witnessed a large part of what happened. So, you know, it's silly because, you know, hallucinations are derangements of the mind, and they just aren't something that affects seven people uniformly.
Right. So what has that been like all these years dealing with the debunkers and skeptics? Has that been real disheartening?
It's been frustrating because, you know, they will go online and post stuff that I totally refuted a long time ago. They know it's false. But when I go on to their website and try to post something to that effect, they won't allow me to post.
Wow.
They'll allow other people who agree with them to post. So they're propagandists. They're blatantly lying to the public, pretending that they're just putting out information.
Now, when you're saying that you can't post, are you saying that you post something and they remove it?
Yeah, they will not put it up. I'll put it in, submit it, and they won't allow it.
Wow. Wow. And this has happened in one or more than one case?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what are, you know, before the internet, what was the type of things you were dealing with the debunkers and skeptics?
Well, you know, they would say they'd dig up any kind of dirt they could. You know, anybody that had a bad word to say about me and my family or the crew or anything, they would just, without any checking, oh, that's got to be true, so we'll put that up. Mm-hmm. And anything good said, they would just not repeat it. Mm-hmm. You know, calling all the bars in town. Well, he doesn't come in here. Okay, we're not going to talk about that. Rather than saying, we called the bars and he doesn't come in there. You know, had they said, oh, he comes in here and he's a big drunk and, you know, he's always making up crazy stories, they would have just run with that.
I think people that would go through what you went through would probably turn to alcohol.
The selective digging for mm-hmm. dirt, anything, you know, the implication being that, of course, a genuine incident of this sort can only happen to a person with a perfect past and a perfect record, mm. has nothing wrong in their life, and who's that? You know, look at the dirt they dig up on all the presidents for the last six presidents. You know, they always find something about them. Their opponents do. So. Nobody's that perfect, and it's just an absurd, just a technique of character assassination.
Sure. You know, when you bring that up, it makes me wonder what the legacy of this whole thing will be. Say, when we're long gone, 50 years from now, do you ever wonder in that scope what things will be?
Well, I'll definitely have the last laugh, because the truth always comes out in the end, and mm-hmm. The longer it goes, the more their claims and their distortions of the truth come back on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that's continuing to put something out and that they know isn't true.
Yep. Now, here's something I don't know if anyone's ever asked you. What do you feel about other people that claim they were abducted? Do you take it case by case?
It's definitely case by case. I don't just say, well, this happened to me, so anybody that ever claims it must be telling the truth, because, mm-hmm. You know, although many people who are telling the truth still didn't have what a real event happened to them. There's all kinds of...
What do you mean by that exactly?
In other words, there's all kinds of things other than exactly what they think happened. There's all kinds of misidentifications or, you know, vivid dreams, all those kinds of things. But I'm not dismissing all claims under that. I'm just saying some of them are that and some aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the skeptics are fond of pointing to something like a known hoax or something like that, mm-hmm. and saying, see, we proved this one, so that means they're all that way.
Right.
And you don't have to defend every case to say that there's a reality here, a core reality. And there's very good reports from very reliable people. And those are the ones that prove that this is a real phenomenon. The existence of, you know, misidentified objects and various other kinds of things doesn't prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've given the example of, you know, you can prove that iron pyrite or fool's gold exists, but that doesn't prove that gold doesn't exist. And, you know, it's really along the same line of thinking.
Yeah, yeah, wow. So this has been absolutely great, Travis. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today. And I'm going to listen to you speak tonight at this conference. And thanks so much for being on this show. I really do appreciate it.
Well, good to be on.
All right. So this is Martin Willis with Travis Walton, and that's it for today.